I usually found it hard to judge the age of black people. He always looked solemn, even grave. His eyes always seemed to be bloodshot. "There's really not much for you to do around here, is there?" I asked him once, while he was running me through the diagnostic scanner. His red-rimmed eyes focused on the readouts, Dr. Waller answered, "Be glad of that, Mr. Humphreys." Even though his face was somber, he constantly hummed to himself, so low I could barely hear it, a tuneless background buzzing. His voice had a sort of singing lilt to it. If I kept my eyes closed, I could imagine him smiling happily instead of the dour, somber face he actually wore. "You can put your shirt on," he said as the scanner yoke lifted up and slid back into its niche in the infirmary bulkhead. "Will I live, doctor?" I kidded. He nodded briefly but said, "Your triglyceride count is rising. Too many sweets. Must I put a block on the dispensing machines?" I laughed. "I'm the owner of this vessel, remember? I could remove any block that you code into the galley's computer." "Then we shall have to rely on your good sense. You need more exercise and less fatty food." I nodded. "Right. Otherwise, you are in excellent condition." As I sealed the Velcro front of my shirt, I asked, "With everyone in good health and no accidents to deal with, how do you fill in your time?" His normally solemn expression brightened a little. "I am writing my PhD thesis. I took this position so that I would have the time to write it, and no distractions, no interruptions, no excuses to put it off." "What is the subject of your thesis?" "The underlying similarities among the organisms of Mars, the Jovian moons, and Earth." "Well," I said, "maybe we'll find some organisms on Venus to broaden your scope." Dr. Waller actually smiled, a bright flashing smile full of white teeth. "I hardly think so, Mr. Humphreys. I chose this mission specifically because I do not expect any new data to come up and cause me added complications." During the first week of our flight, I met Marguerite Duchamp exactly twice. The first time was shortly after we broke Earth orbit. Once we were safely through the keyhole and on the proper trajectory toward Venus, Captain Duchamp left Rodriguez in charge of the bridge and asked me to come with her to the captain's cabin, as she called it. It was a compartment off the bridge only a few paces along the passageway from my own quarters.
"I want you to meet the expedition's biologist," she said over her shoulder as she slid open the compartment door.
"Your daughter," I said as I entered the cubicle. It was quite a small compartment, barely room enough for a bunk and a fold-out table. She was at the bunk, taking clothes out of a travel bag that lay open atop it. She did not turn around when she heard the door open.
"Marguerite, I want you to meet the owner of this vessel."
She turned, looking slightly surprised. I suppose I looked surprised, too. Stunned, actually. Marguerite was a duplicate of her mother. Younger, of course, not so taut or intimidating, yet so physically alike that I thought she must be a clone. The same tall, slim figure, the same sculptured cheekbones and strong jaw, the same jet-black eyes and raven hair. Yet, where her mother was demanding and dominating, the daughter seemed troubled, uncertain of herself. The mother wore her shoulder-length hair severely pulled back. The daughter's flowed softly and was considerably longer.
"This is Mr. Van Humphreys," Duchamp said.
Then to me,
"My daughter, Marguerite, Martin's son," she murmured, taking a step toward me.
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw her mother bristle. I extended my hand. "Pleased to meet you, Ms. Duchamp." She touched my hand briefly. Her fingers felt warm, pulsing.
"Marguerite has a doctorate in biology from Oxford," Duchamp said, flatly, as if it were a challenge, not a trace of parental pride in her voice. Then she added, "I thought you two should meet."
"I'm happy to make your acquaintance," I said to Marguerite. Glancing at her mother, I added, "although I'm afraid there won't be much for you to do on this mission." She did not smile back. Very seriously, she said,
"Perhaps I can help with some of the other scientific observations, then."
Her voice was low, soft, resigned. The cabin seemed cold enough to start a glacier.
"We'll find something useful for you to do, don't worry," Captain Duchamp said. "Yes, Mother, I'm sure you will."
I decided it was time to get out of there. The bitterness between mother and daughter was thick enough to cut with a chainsaw. Dr. Waller said I should exercise, so I started jogging through the warren of passageways and cargo bays of Truax.
The old factory ship's major cargo hold, which once carried huge tonnages of asteroidal ores, was like a vast cave made of metal. Our expedition's crated supplies hardly filled one corner of it. The outgoing crew had worked hard to clean up the holds for us. They had even opened the bays to the vacuum of space for several days on end. Still, the metal bulkheads were dingy with dust. I could feel it crunching on the soles of my running shoes. When I ran a hand along a bulkhead, the metal felt gritty. My fingers came away stained with dust. It made me grin, though. I was touching the dust of other worlds. Instead of sitting at home and staring at virtual reality simulations, I was actually out here, touching other worlds, planetoids that had floated in the silent emptiness of space for billions of years, since the time when the solar system had been created. Then I discovered the bay that held the old smelter, silent and unused now, yet I could sense the heat of the big nuclear-powered ovens as they had melted down the ores in the first step of the refining process. Pulverized chunks of asteroidal rock had been ruthlessly liquefied here, all their minor elements driven out to be collected by the mass separators, purified into the metals and minerals that were building the human race's expanding civilization. For the first time, I got an inkling of what my father's corporations actually did. They were converting ancient leftovers from the creation of the solar system into habitats and factories and spacecraft for the men and women who were living and working in space on the moon and Mars, in the armored modules floating on the ice of Jupiter's major moons. From the catwalk high above the smelter, I drank in the heat that seemed to still hang in the air like a living presence. I could hear in my mind the growling roar of the rock crushers, the shuddering rumble of the conveyor belts that carried the pulverized ore into the white-hot fury of the smelter. When I closed my eyes, I could see the glowing streams of man-made lava flowing into the separators in the next huge bay. All silent now, except for the soft echo of my running shoes padding against the metal grillwork of the catwalk. All stilled, unused, because I had decided in a reckless, angry moment to take up my father's challenge. As he knew I would. That understanding came to me as I jogged along the catwalk, hit me so hard I stopped and gripped the handrail, feeling almost dizzy. He maneuvered me into this. He knew I'd take up his challenge. Or did he merely hope that I would? Either way, I rose to his bait and snapped at it. Why did he do it? Why did he set all that up, the party, the announcement, the prize? Just to get me off my butt and send me to Venus? To get me out of his way? To kill me, the same way Alex was killed? Why? Competition. I was walking along the passageway toward my stateroom, cooling down from my run, sweaty and smelly in my running suit, when I saw Marguerite Duchamp coming up the passageway from the other direction. I had seen her exactly once since her mother performed that awkward, anger-edged introduction on the day we left Earth orbit. Marguerite had kept pretty much to her quarters, and to tell the truth, I kept pretty much to mine, except for my daily exercise runs. Come to think of it, she might have been poking around the big old ship or working on the bridge as much as her mother, and I wouldn't have known it. I couldn't get over how much she resembled her mother, like a younger twin or a clone. The same dark hair and eyes, the same slim, supple figure. She was slightly taller than me, but then almost everybody was slightly taller than me. Father called me runt because I am small. There's no getting away from that fact. She was wearing the standard dun-colored coveralls with flat-heeled shipboard slippers. No matter how much she looked like her mother, though, Marguerite was obviously younger, fresher, without her mother's brittle armor of haughtiness, more approachable. I saw that she had sewn a bright green armband on the left sleeve of her coveralls. As she approached me, I noticed that her thick dark hair was tied back with a green ribbon that matched the armband. "You're one of them," I blurted. Her onyx eyes flashed at me. "Them?" she asked. "The Greens." She seemed to visibly relax. "Of course," she answered casually. "Isn't everybody?" "I'm not." I reversed my course and fell into step beside her. "Why aren't you?" she asked, apparently not noticing that I was sweaty and smelly and must have looked a mess. Her question puzzled me for a moment. I guess I've never paid that much attention to politics. Marguerite shrugged. With your money, I suppose you don't have to.
My father's very involved, I said. It came out sounding defensive.